This is a great group of texts to make a point that I've made lots and lots of time before. Namely, that when we read the New Testament, we're reading a 2,000-year-old document. We're not reading the London Free Press or the New York Times or the Boston Globe. So these people obviously had a much, much different view of the world than we do. The world was flat for them, because all you had to do is look around. It doesn't look like it's curved to me. Diseases were caused by some demonic influence or some evil. Okay, all this is part and parcel of their culture. And yet we continue, I think, very often to hear these texts with quite different ears. And that's what I want to point out today. In the gospel reading, that famous final line, "Come to me, all you who are labor and are burdened," Jesus was a peasant, lived among peasants, preached to peasants, and so he was not talking to the Jerusalem bourgeoisie, which probably did not exist. There are only two classes, the top and the bottom. So when he's talking about burdens, he's not saying, "Oh my God, my computer's busted," or "I've lost my iPhone again." No. Those are not the burdens that are in play here. The burdens are sheer physical exhaustion, you know. So that's what's being addressed here, and that's what Jesus is promising some respite from. But it's the stuff from Paul which has bedeviled centuries and centuries of Catholic thought, and not just Catholic thought either. This whole business of the opposition between flesh and spirit. So we hear it not with Jewish ears, because Paul was a Jew, thought like a Jew, saw things as a Jew, but with Greek ears. Well, we all know that the Greeks have always puzzled me, because on the one hand, they denigrate the body. The flesh, it's nasty, you know, it's going to die. But then there's the soul, which is heaven-bound, you know, and not attached to anything down here, really. Because it's dissolvable from the body, or separable from the body. And that's the church I grew up in, because sex, the highest embodiment of bodiliness, was the third rail, the ecclesiastical third rail. It's embedded all over the place. Probably the most telling example came from my moral theology class, says, 4 bloody years of this stuff, and they were bloody. We hear this text with Greek ears. So it's the genitals that are the object of scorn. No, the Jews had genitals. The Jews love sex. There's all kinds of, read the Song of Songs if you don't believe me. A Jewish text. Okay, but as I said, the Greeks puzzled me, because on one hand they denigrate the body and elevate the spirit. I've not been able to figure out exactly why they did that, but there's no question that they did. You know? And we have been burdened, I think I was at least, I suspect most of you or many of you at least, were burdened with that same kind of dichotomized world of the flesh and the spirit, meaning your genitalia and this amorphous, that's exactly the right word too, bodily reality that was your soul. You know? So, why am I bringing this up? Because in years of hearing confessions, several things became very clear to me. sex was the only real sin. It was embodied in moral theology, the textbooks that we use in seminary. Non dater paritas materiae in materia sexualibus. There is no poverty, there is no smallness of matter when you're talking about sex. You can have theft, you have grand theft, little bitty theft, you can have murders or somebody being punched out. And all those would exist in graded form. Not sex, boy. You even had to think about sex intensively, and that was a mortal sin. You didn't have to do anything. Just think about it and enjoy it. You're thinking. And you're going to hell, because that was a mortal sin. And if you did anything sexual, wow, game's over, folks. You just, you know, you're literally up the creek without a paddle. And as I said, hearing confession, the thing that drove me nuts, and not just me, but the pathology that I found expressed in a bunch of people's confession, the majority, had to do with sex. You know? There's this one poor creature, and this is breaking the seal of confession, but nobody knows who this woman was, so I'm going to proceed. Every week she'd show up in the confession of Father, I sat on the toilet seat. I would kind of anticipate that. No, touching the toilet seat. You're very close to your genitals when you touch the toilet seat. I'm not making that up. I know from my mother, I learned to detest my own body. And I'm not exaggerating. I won't go into gory detail, but that's the fact. This good German peasant woman, you know, standing faithful in the tradition of anti-sex beliefs that were passed on to her by some good German nuns, I'm sure. Well, it's... I remember going into King's Chapel, the moment of great liberation for me that day. Here I am, God, penis and all. You know. So I stood there and said, yeah, here I am, and this is the fullness of my being, and you made it, and you made it do what it does, or I make it do, and it's all right. You know. But I would love to know what they're teaching about sex in the Catholic schools these days. And I have not stayed up with the whole moral theology thing. Gil, you're a moral theologian. What did you guys do with sex? You're much later than I am on the scene.
Well, a decade or so.
Pardon?
A decade or so. It was pretty much the same.
See that? Nietzsche, God love him, said the worst thing you could do to somebody else is to make them ashamed of themselves. The worst thing you can do, and I think he was right, to make somebody else ashamed of who they were. You know? I happen to be a sexed being, and my mother was convinced that that was a totally nasty aspect of my existence that I'd be best to ignore. You know? I don't know what your experience was, but my experience, I know for an absolute fact, was not unusual. You know? And it perdures. The Bible was written by a bunch of men. So you look at the wisdom literature, what's that about? It's advice to a young man who's going to be a nobleman someplace along the line. And the primary advice was, avoid women. They're all seductresses. They all want to get into your trousers. You know, Only a man 3,000 years ago could say some asinine thing like that. But they did. And it's ensconced in the Bible. Now I don't want to mislead you, because sex is essentially mysterious, I think. On all kinds of grounds, the sexual experience is unlike any other. There's a saying that having orgasm is the body singing. Well, the rest of the time, the body can't carry a tune, you know, which I think is right. Is that right? No, it's not right. It's intentionality. You can use sex to buy stuff, to sell stuff, to do all kinds of subhuman things, but you can use anything, with the same devious, perverted purposes. And it doesn't take... I'm afraid there were a couple of books I wanted to read again that I used at King's. Do you remember that? The guy, sex book. Ah, from Montreal. He took the French name.
Yeah, Andre...
I can't remember, but you're right with Andre. So I don't know. It was a scandal. It horrified people. And this was 50 years ago, folks. And I bet the same book is under interdict today. So not surprisingly, since we have demonized sex, a new generation has tended to angelize sex, which is quite as much a perversion. I don't know whether you guys remember the free love days, where sex was your favorite indoor sport, you know? Loveless sex is as evil as loveless purchasing, loveless money lending, loveless anything. But it's clear to everybody in this room that sex is not loveless. Or certainly need not be, and normally is not. I can't imagine having a sexual relationship with somebody whom I did not love. It is inconceivable to me. I'm fairly inexperienced in these matters, but you don't need to have PhDs in physiology and psychology and all those other things to recognize the fallaciousness of that attitude and how dangerous it's been, how much perversion it's been. That's why the angelization of sex is simply the opposite side of the demonization of sex. If sex is altogether bad, then sex is altogether good. It's not. It's a human thing, and so can be used perversely, like everything else. You know, there's nothing in human life. Artistic talent can be used perversely, for that matter, which seems to be as close as you get to pure experience, the purity of experience in my life, at least. So, please, save this nice Jew, Paul, from hearing him with Greek ears. He wasn't a Greek. He spoke Greek. He wrote Greek. That didn't make him a cultural Greek, however. And so you have generations, probably millennia, of people reading this passage from Romans, and it's not alone in the Pauline corpus. Saying, oh my God, he's talking about the no-nos. No, he's not talking about the no-nos. He's talking about what is pervertible. And there's nothing in life that is not pervertible. Full stop. but that we have demonized sex. Long, long tradition. I wish some of you guys had heard the confessions I've heard. People are terrified of their own bodies. Very often. Imagine growing up like that. Did God stop creation from the neck down? I don't think so. So, I don't have any simple answers. As I said, I've been trying to figure out the Greeks too, because on one hand they did both. They angelized sex and they demonized it. But that's all right. Sex was part of the body, and the body's a piece of rubbish anyway. So you can do whatever you want with your body, and your soul will remain pristine and pure. That's utter rubbish. So, and because it perverts, it pervades, I think that's the word I want, pervades the writings of Paul and other people in the New Testament. It's spooky. And I would highly recommend that you go to your Bibles and read the Song of Songs, one of the most intensely erotic pieces of literature in the world. It's a good exercise, and thank God for your sexuality.